Division 7, Colorado Court of Appeals. We have three cases set for oral argument this afternoon. The first one is People against Roberts. I see the council are ready to proceed, so go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Nathaniel Deakins, registration number 38752, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Roberts, from the Law Office of Doug Wilson. In the opening brief, Mr. Roberts raised four issues for your review. Today, subject, of course, to your questions and concerns, I'd like to discuss the first issue. As for the three remaining issues, unless time permits otherwise, Mr. Roberts will rest on the arguments presented in the opening brief. In this case, Your Honors, the prosecutor, either consciously or subconsciously, misstated the evidence of its own witnesses in order to win a conviction. The prosecutor also improperly argued that Mr. Roberts ran from the scene of the incident and that his running away showed his consciousness of guilt. As I'll explain later, and contrary to the Attorney General's argument in the answer brief, the evidence of guilt was far from overwhelming in this case, which is an indication of why the prosecutor might have relied on this argument and these two types of arguments. So, what happened exactly? As I explained in the opening brief, there were two objectionable or improper arguments in the closing argument. The first occurred in the initial closing argument, where the prosecutor argued that the defendant, what did the defendant do? The defendant runs away, and his running away is evidence of his consciousness of guilt. The prosecutor went on to contrast his actions with the victim in this case, who stayed to talk to the police, which drew an objection from defense counsel on Fifth Amendment grounds. But for purposes here, I'd like to focus on the improper argument, sort of leave the Fifth Amendment argument to the brief. If time permits, maybe I can address that later. But
counsel, can I ask you, was there any other can you hear me okay? I'm not sure these are amplifying.
Yes.
Was there any discussion of flight or any instruction about flight other than the prosecutor's argument that, you know, where is the defendant? He fled.
As my recollection is that there was no instruction requested.
Okay. So was there any, express discussion of flight other than the argument in terms of in the evidence?
Well, yeah, our point is that there was no evidence of flight and that the prosecutor improperly argued it. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Yeah, in terms of the, and I think you are, I may not be articulating it. Did the prosecutor present a theory of the case that this was flight? And it is a distinction in the cases I think both of you talk about between conduct or comment on conduct versus a comment on the defendant's exercising the right to remain silent. And I anticipate the Attorney General will argue that this was just a comment on conduct. And I'm trying to figure out, prior to the time when the prosecutor made this argument about where's the defendant, he fled, was there discussion about the doctrine of flight? Because there are cases that say that could be admissible to show consciousness of guilt. That's what I'm trying to get to. Or was that the first time anyone mentioned the word flight or fleeing?
Well, and to be fair, I don't think that the word flight actually came out of the prosecutor's mouth. I think it was couched in terms of the defendant was running away. He repeatedly relied on this argument, the defendant was running away. And I don't want to get sidetracked necessarily on that issue because I think that's what the prosecutor was trying to do from fair reading of the closing argument. However, really what the problem was that there was no evidence that Mr. Roberts ran away. And in fact, the evidence was that he was escorted out, and which contradicts the argument that Mr. Roberts ran away. So I don't think there was any conversation in the record prior to the jury instructions, the jury instructional in the conference regarding flight, nor was there, if I remember correctly, any kind of discussion off the record, not in front of the jury, about flight.
When you're saying there is no evidence, maybe I need to be more, evidence of what? I mean, it was undisputed the defendant left. whether he fled or in whatever, or was, and there's a debate over whether there was evidence of whether he was escorted, and an issue about who had personal knowledge. It's undisputed he wasn't there and he left.
Right.
So what more evidence, evidence was lacking to support the prosecution's argument?
Well, I think that the case law is clear that in order to support a lot of the cases discuss it in terms of whether the prosecution is entitled to an instruction on flight. However, I think the reasoning is the same in terms of whether it's fair game for the prosecutor to argue flight, because there's nothing to suggest anything other than that Mr. Roberts left. And there are two elements, I think, that the cases bear out, People v. Summit, and going back to, I guess, Robinson would be one of the earlier cases, and also leading treatises that I think I mentioned in the brief, that there needs to be something in addition to just that he left, normal human locomotion, that there must be some evidence that he was aware he was being sought. Otherwise, it becomes this circular type of reasoning that he's guilty because he ran away, and he ran away because he's guilty. So, but I think more pressing is that, and I just wanted to point out, because there's a discrepancy between the briefs about whether there was testimony that he was escorted out, I just wanted to point to a few points in the record or direct your attention to those places, because the prosecutor himself actually intentionally elicited this testimony that Mr. Roberts was escorted out, and then in closing argued that there was no testimony that he was escorted out. So during the testimony of Carla Waller, who was the victim's girlfriend, who was there the night of the incident, she testified that I guess once we were out of the club, that's when they escorted Quentin out. And the prosecutor asked, so you don't know how he happened to go from actually being in that room that you were in to being out of the club? And she replied, no, I didn't see all of that. So somewhat ambiguous, but you still have the statement, her initial statement, and before the prosecutor asked this leading question, that's when they escorted Quentin out.
Excuse me, is it your position that the evidence is undisputed that he was escorted out?
I think that it is uncontroverted.
Uncontroverted that he was escorted out. So
I think
the jury would be required to conclude that he was escorted out. That's your position?
I think that there are witnesses who testify that they don't know what happened. Uncontroverted evidence was that after this incident, the establishment began to ask people to leave, people were leaving, and that the only testimony, one way or the other, what do you know what happened to Mr. Roberts, was that he was escorted out. Okay. And
I think I understand your position, and it seems to me that if he did not leave of his own volition, if he was escorted out, then I think you're right that there's no inference of consciousness of guilt that can be based on that. If, on the other hand, the evidence supports an inference that he left of his own volition, wouldn't you agree that it would support an inference that he did so to avoid being apprehended?
I don't think so, Your Honor, given the special nature of this type of evidence, and the Supreme Court, in cases such as Robinson, all the way down through Summit, have placed on this type of evidence, saying that the jury is apt to, and I think you'll find this in evidence treatises everywhere, that this type of evidence is something that the jury will latch onto, and without this proper factual predicate to admit this evidence, that it's improper for a prosecutor to highlight it.
But what is the predicate? I mean, is it that the evidence must be able to support an inference that he left to avoid detection or apprehension, or is it that we need some kind of direct evidence of his motive?
I believe that there must be some evidence of his motive.
So something more than a mere suggestion that could be the reason.
Correct. Well, I agree. Or that's our point. However, again, I would go back to the fact that not only was there no evidence, the prosecutor misstated the evidence about being escorted out. In fact, later on during the testimony of Carla Waller, who testified that Mr. Roberts was escorted out, but then said, well, I don't really know what happened, the prosecutor read this statement, her alleged previous statement to an officer on the night of the incident, and the prosecutor actually read the entire report to Ms. Waller and said, isn't that true, basically? In the report, the prosecutor asked Ms. Waller, isn't it true that you stated that other people in the bar grabbed Mr. Roberts and escorted him outside? And that was the statement that she gave to an officer that night of the incident, and she said, yes, that's true. So I think that the record bears out that uncontroverted, was, the testimony is uncontroverted that he was escorted out. And
Counsel, maybe you can help me fit these, the two issues we're talking about together. I may have gotten you a little sidetracked here on this flight issue. Your principal argument is that this was an improper comment on the defendant's right to remain silent, exercise of that right. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that the evidence would support an inference of flight. Just take that for argument's sake.
Okay.
Does that undermine the argument about the right to remain silent, or do you still have that argument? How do those two things fit together?
Yes, well, I feel like these different bases in the law for objecting to this argument sort of overlap. And I do think that if there was a factual predicate for the flight instruction, and had the prosecutor properly sought an instruction, then perhaps the comment would not be objectionable under Fifth Amendment grounds. Perhaps. However, that's not the case. Not the case here, Your Honor. So I believe that those two, the Sixth Amendment argument and the Fifth Amendment argument, are both relevant and persuasive, given that there is no factual predicate for the argument.
Right. But you gave us your perhaps, but what factors would we consider? I want you to assume, you know, hypothetically, that this division would say there was enough evidence to support an argument on flight, or even a flight instruction if it was asked for. What would we consider then in looking at the Fifth Amendment argument? You said perhaps. I'm trying to figure out, how do we make that decision if we have to get there?
Well, the prosecutor was drawing a negative inference from Mr. Roberts' failure to give statements to police officers. And in so doing, they argued that, well, their way of doing that was arguing that he ran away. Again, there's no evidence of that. However, there's still, if the evidence is relevant for some other reason, perhaps flight, argument on flight, well, then there are other interests at play. However, in this case, because that's not true, then there's a direct inference of guilt drawn from his failure to give statements to police officers. Now, I'd like to point out just a couple other things, and I would like to reserve a little bit of time for rebuttal, but further problems with this statement of evidence was that the trial court simply overruled the defense objection without comment, and in so doing, effectively endorsed the prosecution's view of the evidence. Didn't provide an instruction, a cautionary instruction that, you know, closing argument is evidence. The trial court did provide that instruction before the closing arguments. However, I think that only highlights or strengthens the argument that this endorses the prosecution's view of the evidence. And in addition, immediately following the trial court's overruling of the objection, the prosecutor again said, no, you never heard that. There was no one who escorted it out. But no one who escorted Mr. Roberts out. And I would be remiss to not point out that while the record isn't clear that this was intentional, and I don't think it ultimately matters whether it was or not, there was also a mistrial issue where the prosecutor failed to adequately prepare his witness. And I think that combined with the prosecutor's misstating the evidence shows some recklessness, either recklessness or intentional activity. I would like to reserve some time for rebuttals.
Certainly.
May it please the court. I'm Jennifer Berman, registration number 35882, and I represent the people in this matter. I would first just like to briefly state, at the end of opposing counsel's argument, he stated that he set forth kind of a cumulative error argument based on the denial of the motion for a mistrial in conjunction with the alleged prosecutorial misconduct. And I would just like to point out that was never presented in the briefs, that those two would constitute cumulative error. As to opposing counsel, I will address only the prosecutorial misconduct issue here, unless there are questions on the other issues. Judge Gabriel, in response to your question as to how the issue with flight and the issue with the alleged comment on silence fit together, I would argue that they don't fit together at all. In fact, if counsel is objecting to the evidence that, or the statement that the defendant ran away as some sort of comment on the exercise of the right to silence, that's clearly not the case because that's conduct. That's not silence.
Well, where's the line, counsel? I mean, the argument here, as I don't have it right in front of me, was essentially, you know, victim, you know, he stayed and he talked to the cops. And where is the defendant? He left. And that shows consciousness of guilt. That was the argument that was made, as I understand it. The clear suggestion to the jury, in my mind, was the defendant didn't stay to talk to the cops. And that shows consciousness of guilt. Why isn't that a comment on the right to remain silent?
First of all, I would argue that's not a clear indication that the defendant didn't stay and talk to the police. I think it was a clear indication that the defendant left, the defendant ran away from the scene, and the defendant tried to avoid detection. But
what evidence was there of that? That the evidence, I'll grant you, I think there was evidence that the defendant left.
Right.
Okay.
It was uncontested.
What evidence is there that the defendant tried to avoid detection by leaving? Maybe he was afraid he was going to get his butt kicked by the bigger guy who he just hit with a bottle.
I think it was a reasonable inference from the evidence presented that he was trying to avoid detection based on the fact that it was uncontroverted that he left. He was not at the bar when the police arrived 4 minutes later. And secondly, after interviewing the employees, the victim, and his girlfriend at the club, the police officers immediately went to the defendant's home. They found a vehicle that matched the description given by the victim's girlfriend of the defendant's vehicle, touched the hood of it, discovered that it was still warm, thus indicating that he had recently driven it, found a black leather jacket matching the description given by the victim's girlfriend of the jacket the defendant was wearing that night, shined a flashlight on the jacket, found what they determined to be blood based on the appearance of it, went to the defendant's home, knocked on the door, and there was no answer. And I think from that, it's a reasonable interpretation that the defendant fled the scene and was trying to avoid detection.
Did the prosecutor ever argue any of that?
I think that's what the argument that we're—
I'm talking about at trial. Did the prosecutor make that argument at any point in time?
Well, the prosecutor presented that evidence from which the argument was made during closing arguments.
And the argument that was made was the one that we just chatted about. Where's the defendant? He's not. He left.
The defendant.
Right? I'm just trying to— are you focused on some other part of the closing argument?
I'm trying to separate them out. I think that what you have is when defense counsel objects on the basis of this is a Fifth Amendment violation, what he's objecting to really is the comment that the victim stayed and talked to the police, and the mere fact that the prosecutor had just finished talking about the defendant's conduct, well, that in of itself creates this negative inference that the defendant did not stay and talk to the police. But I think if you look at the context of the argument as a whole, what you see is that the prosecutor was comparing the victim's conduct to the conduct of the defense witnesses immediately before discussing the defendant.
Well, didn't he do it both at the same time? I'm troubled by this argument, I'll be candid with you. He said the defendant and his witnesses all left in juxtaposition to the comment that the victim stayed and talked to the police. And then that's when the defense lawyer got up and say, I object. It's a comment on the defendant's, you know, Fifth Amendment rights. Now, I understand the prosecutor said, we're just talking about the victim. Be candid with you. I'm troubled. I don't buy that. And so in context, we have a juxtaposition of the defendants, of the prosecution saying the victim stayed and he talked to the cops. And where'd the defendant go? He fled. The necessary inferences, and he didn't stay to talk to the cops. And I'm troubled, and again, I'll come back to where I started. Where is the line? I mean, you could say anytime somebody doesn't speak, that's conduct. Where's the line? I mean, the leading case on conduct was a case where defendants read his Miranda rights, and the cops asked on the stand, and how did he respond? And the case involved the defendant started blowing kisses at the cop because he was drunk. Evidence comes in there as conduct to show the guy was drunk. not a statement on the Fifth Amendment. Where is the line that says this is conduct versus a comment on speech?
I think the line is drawn, well, I would say the line is drawn where the defendant is being asked questions and clearly not responding to those questions. However, you do have that case where the defendant was being asked questions, and in response, and I believe that's the Hall case, in response he's blowing kisses to the police officer. So you have formal questioning, you have a defendant who is in the face of accusation, and yet still that conduct is not seen as silence. It's not the exercise of the right to silence, it's in fact conduct. And here, you don't even have that, you're not even close to that line, because you simply have the defendant leaving the scene. And in response to your question of couldn't every time the defendant is silent be seen as flight, couldn't every time the defendant flees the scene therefore be seen as silence? And that's not the case. It's clear that you can present evidence of flight and you can give an instruction that is consciousness of guilt, and you're not running afoul of the Fifth Amendment in doing that.
All right, so you would draw the line that there has to be some sort of questioning before you get to the issue of the problem of commenting on silence. And here no one was asking the defendant any questions, so we don't have that issue.
Right, I don't think his Fifth Amendment rights were yet triggered. There was no police questioning, there was no accusation yet. He simply left the scene. He was not compelled to either speak or remain silent. That circumstance hadn't been presented to him yet, right, because the police hadn't arrived.
Counsel, in your view, is custody a necessary component in this analysis?
I don't think it is, based on the case law as it's developed. I think that the Welsh case presents that you can have, I know you can at least have pre-Miranda silence be improperly commented upon, and I know that in that case that even included nurses asking the defendant questions, and I don't think that he was necessarily deemed to be in custody at that point. I think it's if there's formal questioning of the defendant under a circumstance in which he is facing accusation, and you do not have that here. The police hadn't arrived yet. The defendant quickly left, whether he was escorted out or not. And if I could, I'd like to discuss that. I think there was ample evidence to support the inference that he was not escorted out. And most of that comes from the victim's girlfriend's statement at trial, in which she says, "And I guess once we were out of the club, that's when they escorted Quentin out," thus clearly demonstrating that she didn't have personal knowledge of how he got out of the club. She was simply presuming that he was escorted out. She follows that up with further testimony that she did not see how the defendant got out because she was accompanying the victim to tend to his wound. So she admits that she didn't have personal knowledge of it. Now, she told the police officer when they arrived that the defendant was escorted out, and perhaps that was just her assumption based on the fact that the defendant had just started a fight. Maybe they escorted him out of the club. But even if he were escorted out of the club, he still wasn't at the scene. He still ran away from the scene and went to his home, and his car was there, and yet when they, and clearly he had just arrived because the car, the hood of the car was still warm, when they arrive at his home, he doesn't answer the door. Interestingly, all of that evidence that does give you a reasonable inference that he ran away from the scene and that he was conscious of his guilt in doing so, none of that was objected to.
Counsel, do we have any evidence that he, any testimony that he left the club of his own volition? Did anybody see him leave?
We don't have any testimony concerning how he left the club. We just know that he left the club. I think it's interesting that the bouncer, Mr. Jones, did not testify to escorting the defendant out of the club, and I would presume that if anyone were going to be escorting him, it would be the bouncer, and he didn't give any testimony to that effect.
Well, there was evidence that there were people who were grabbing both of these guys to prevent the fight. I mean,
right, there was evidence that people were holding them back within the club.
Presumably.
But we don't have evidence that he was being escorted outside of the club, or that he ran away himself. However, I think based on the evidence we do have, it is a reasonable inference that he ran away. And it's proper for the prosecutor to comment on that reasonable inference. If there are no more questions, I would ask that
I did have one, Counsel, and this is related to the point that you're making. I recognize you're talking about, was there evidence to support the flight argument? The defendant also raises an issue on prosecutorial misconduct based on misstating the evidence. And I guess I want your take on this. The prosecutor argued, as I understand it, you did not, to the jury, you did not hear one witness say the defendant was escorted. I understand your argument that the witnesses who testified may not have had personal knowledge, but the fact is there were witnesses who did testify he was escorted. The girlfriend did, and I think the police officer did either directly or by way of the report, right?
So well, again, the girlfriend testified that I believe he was escorted out. I was with the victim, so I didn't see it, but I believe that's when they escorted him out. And based on her statement to the police officer who obviously had no personal knowledge of it because she arrived after the incident and after the defendant had left, had said, she told me that the defendant was escorted out. However, if you look
and
at the context—
And the jury did hear that, right?
The jury did hear that, but if you look at the context of it, the prosecutor said, you heard testimony about him moving back across that room and about people losing track of where he was and about people who ran away themselves and left without knowing where he went, but you never heard anybody say that he was escorted out of the bar. And I think it's important that it's coupled with the statement that you hear about people losing track of where he was. And so that right there shows that nobody really knew how he got out of the bar. And perhaps it would have been better stated to say nobody had personal knowledge that he was escorted out of the bar. The prosecutor said, you never heard he was escorted out of the bar. But I think from the context of that statement, what you get is that nobody knew exactly how he left. We know he wasn't there. And if you look at the evidence in its entirety, it's reasonable to infer that he ran away.
Sure. But and I just really want to have the facts right in my own mind. There was evidence, direct evidence, that somebody said he was escorted out, just as a factual matter, right?
The police officer did say that.
Okay, that's. I just want to clarify.
The police officer testified. The police officer testified to that.
Okay.
However, she also admitted after testifying to that that she didn't write it in her police report that they had told the defendant to leave or escorted him out. So.
Thanks.
If there are no more questions, I would ask that this court affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Gabriel, just to answer your question, is there testimony whether he was escorted out? I just point, Tom, you to July 18th, 06, trial transcript. It was the second day, page 53, a prosecutor interviewing the detective. Waller told you that Mr. Roberts was escorted out of the club? Yes. She was clear that Mr. Roberts was taken by other patrons or other bouncers, possibly out of the club, and told to leave at that point. Correct. So I just would reiterate that that was the testimony. And I couldn't help but notice in the Attorney General's argument, respectfully, you know, how tempting it is to draw that inference that he ran away. But under this case, the factual predicate necessary wasn't present. You know, they went to his home. They saw his car. They felt the hood. It was warm. He ran away. Well, no, he went home. So I just don't think that the factual predicate necessary is there in this case.
Mr. Deakins, I want to interrupt on this point. It seems to me that the testimony is ambiguous, that we don't know. I think he said, we don't know from this testimony how he got out of the bar. Given that we don't know, isn't the inference that he left on his own just as reasonable as the inference that he didn't? Why is the former inference just precluded, and you're saying we have to accept the latter inference? Why is that?
Well, I think that, as I, Judge Russell asked this earlier, I think that this evidence is so potentially prejudicial, if not used correctly, that that inference cannot be drawn, as the case law suggests, Supreme Court of Colorado, you know, these flight cases, this is evidence that is a special category of evidence where you need this predicate before you introduce it. And that's why it's not a reasonable inference. So even if you don't accept the argument that that the prosecutor misstated the evidence, contradicted the evidence, that he was escorted out, and then no one knew. And still, it's not a reasonable inference. So there's kind of the two, you know, misconduct for misstating the evidence, misconduct for not drawing a reasonable inference when there's this special category of evidence.
Well, are you saying that you have to have direct evidence of flight, that circumstantial evidence isn't enough? And if that's what you're saying, what's your case law support for that?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not saying that there has to be someone, a videotape of Mr. Roberts, you know, driving the white Bronco down the highway or anything like that with police chasing him. But I am saying that the prosecution has the burden of showing that he was aware that he was being sought. They've simply presented nothing, and therefore they're not entitled to argue that in closing. I see that my time is run out. I don't know if I can make one final point.
Counsel, your time has expired.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Deakins and Ms. Berman. Court thanks both counsel for their arguments. This case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.